Welcome to Third Tuesday Conversation, a monthly podcast that focuses on the ministry of faith formation with children, youth, and families in ELCA congregations. Our goal is to engage in conversations that strengthen and empower your ministry world. This podcast is produced by the ELCA Youth Ministry Network. I'm Adam Butler.
I'm Danica Olson.
And I'm Elizabeth Pedersen.
Hello.
Hello.
Today we're recording live with a live studio audience. Hey, we are joined with
That's so awesome. Nothing has made me feel like more of a rock star than that right there. This is as close as I'm gonna get.
It's true.
This is the moment I've been waiting for.
I don't think so. You were just talking about being in Sports Illustrated, so I think that's probably.
That's true. If anybody ever wants to know that story, I'm happy to tell it.
He also has pictures.
I do. I have proof. It happened. But you know, let's not talk about me. All right, that's not what we're here for. But you can keep talking about me if you want. Yeah.
Okay. we're joined today by Professor Matt Bloom from Notre Dame, and he is here to talk to us about being healthy in ministry. Work well is. How about you tell us about work well? Tell us a little bit about you and what we might be able to chat about today.
Sure. So my area of research that the team and I focused on for 27 years was people that, in the helping and healing professions, we were interested in studying people who found deeply meaningful work and to understand how did they find that kind of work, what does it mean for them to live into it, and what does it mean for them to flourish? And so a large part of our research focused on well-being at work, and what is well-being? How do we know what this thing is that has a kind of ambiguous name? What are the things that challenge or diminish well-being, and what can we do about it? What can we do for our own well-being and for the well-being of the people that we interact with? So we studied. The biggest group we studied were clergy, Christian clergy, across the Protestant denominations and Catholic priests. We studied international aid workers, global health workers, human rights attorneys, public school teachers, physicians and nurses, sort of a wide range. And now I've turned my focus to taking the research we did and many, many others, researchers, and trying to translate it into resources and tools that people like you that are actually doing the work can use. So this is the stage we're in. And thank you for inviting me.
Glad to be here. We're glad to have you. When you're compiling research, that's 27 years, is a really long time. Where do you begin? And how, at least up until now, has it been disseminated, used, and maybe what's your plan with your findings going forward?
Yeah, those are good questions. In my doctoral program, I was trained as a quantitative researcher, which means we launched a lot of surveys and quickly understood that we needed to augment that. And we retrained ourselves in qualitative research, which is basically doing two things, going out and collecting people's stories of their life and their work, and some of the richest and most rewarding experiences was being with people as they just shared this gift of their life. So we might ask a question of, tell me the story of how you became a pastor, how you became a physician. And then, I spent a lot of time traveling overseas and just in the context in which the work was done, or we spent time in local churches or in clinics here. We wanted to understand in particular what it was like to work in what would be called hardship contexts. So, this would be aid workers in Afghanistan or Sudan. And so we needed to be there. I needed to be there and live with them. So the qualitative side has ended up being some of the richest side of that. But then bringing the two together. And for most of the time, it was shared in the form of academic articles. There is a book called Flourishing in Ministry that I wrote that is one of the first attempts to share it with a larger audience. One of the other big projects now, we have developed a mobile application called Ritual that takes the science we know about well-being practices, and then has those practices offered by people like Barbara Brown Taylor or Parker Palmer or Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr. We have a lovely practice on what's called self-affirmation, how to continue to feel good about yourself, by Simone Manuel, who was the first Black Olympic gold medalist in swimming. And so we're really working hard to build that as a resource where you can go and find these audio-based practices that can help you with your well-being.
Cool.
So that's kind of where we were and where we've come. Unfortunately, academic rewards are really built around publishing to each other.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, there's some good to that, but it's really sad because how do you get that out to the real world? Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't want to read our academic articles. They're dense and ponderous and, you know, I mean, they're not written in a way that is engaging. They're not page turners. But also then they tend to, they don't help distill what that article is about to something that you could use.
Yeah.
If I could go just a little bit further.
Please.
So let me give you an example. One of the things that I would say, if you wanted to begin to think about your well-being, think about it as a journey. Like the journey of life. You know, it's a part of your journey. And what that means is that well-being isn't a destination that you'll arrive at. You won't get well-being and keep it. It will change. And life happens, and you know, there used to be a bumper sticker that I'm paraphrasing. Life happens, and so your well-being is going to get knocked around a bit. And that doesn't mean that you've done anything wrong. And so using that metaphor as a journey, we often say that you could think of four steps to flourishing. So the first is step back. And that means just occasionally step back from the flow of life and look at what's going well. And you can celebrate that. But what's not going well? And those are the things you might want to address. Those are the well-being needs you have. And so it's just good to step back occasionally and say, yeah, I am feeling stressed. And then why am I feeling stressed? The second step is step easy, which means your well-being changes usually through the accumulation of little things. And so you don't need to make big changes. In fact, you probably shouldn't make changes. So these simple well-being practices, we could talk about a few, and this is what ritual is trying to offer. That's the way to change. So find a 5-minute contemplative practice. That'd be fantastic. Or try every evening to just spend a little bit of time simply relaxing. These would be some wise well-being practices. So step easy means do little things. Pay attention to them. The third one is step together. There's an overemphasis, I think, in helping and healing professions on self-care. Self-care matters, but the way it's used, it's often like self-care. So if your well-being is low, it's your fault. And it belies the profound truth that we live in ecosystems of well-being. Our well-being is profoundly impacted by the people around us, and we shape theirs. So thinking about those interpersonal and group dynamics that shape your well-being. And who might you partner with or journey with? Who are the people that you can be partners with? And then the last one is step faithfully, that your faith is fundamental to your well-being. And the spiritual practices and spiritual beliefs you have are also well-being practices. And sometimes just knowing that enhances their effect on your well-being. So centering prayer or singing hymns or worship, those are good for your well-being. And so to the extent you found ones that work for you, keep going with them.
Cool.
Thanks for letting me give a mini lecture.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So how are we?
Yeah.
I kind of have that question after, like, you've done so much research and over so many years, and especially through the last, like, you know, 3 or 4 years, right? Like, have you drawn some conclusions? Like, how are we? I mean, obviously you're developing an app and you're writing about this because there's clearly a need for well-being and some focus around it. But like, do you have any general conclusions about how are we as people?
In general in the US, you know, I think there's the pandemic knocked people back. There's some interesting changes that have happened. It's disconnected people from work in a good way. The Great Resignation, quiet quitting. There's a new one now that's called something like rage applying, which means I'm so sick of my job, I'm going to apply. But
I like that one.
I know that's interesting. But what it meant is that people that were so overinvested in their work have now stepped back from a bit. That's good. in the helping and healing professions, in particular people in ministry, they're doing surprisingly well, given the challenges. Still, for example, 40% of people in ministry are experiencing severe to high levels of burnout, and that's alarming. So there are very serious issues that are at stake. But given everything that people in ministry are dealing with, they're doing surprisingly well. The biggest concern I have is that well-being is either something that's talked about occasionally, or it's wrapped in self-care, which I've already said something about that, and that meaningful attention and resources are not being directed at it. And yet, it's hard to imagine a flourishing ministry when you're suffering or languishing. And so I think it's underappreciated. And as mainline denominations are facing shrinking membership, we don't want to use the term dying, but that may be the case, which actually may be God's providence. But anyway, as they're shrinking, then there's this sort of clinging to the hope that we'll grow again and well-being gets pushed further away. And this is one of the reasons that I decided I want to focus on bringing resources to individuals, because you could use them where if we work through the denominational and adjudicatory structures, I think it's going to be hard for them to change and hard for them to get. So there's some good news. There's things that can be done. People are actually doing much better than you would expect them to do. There are some issues to be dealt with and to be recognized. I wish that institutions would change. I pray that they change. I'm not hopeful. Optimistic may be a better word. And so, but there's a lot that we can do as individuals for ourselves and for each other. And that's the really good news. We can help a lot. So that's a long answer to a good short question.
No, it's great. It's great to hear that. I mean, I think it's probably for most of the people listening, that's probably affirming to the way that they feel, right? So I think in some ways I asked the question to affirm the way that I feel. And like, boy, flourishing in ministry really sounds good, you know?
Yeah, but kind of Pollyannish, like.
Yeah, but like, but I think it is important to hear that like people are maybe doing like surprisingly well for what they've experienced, which I think is an accurate thing that I maybe feel about myself or the people around me, but also that like in general that's not really that well anyway, right? Like it's better than it could be, but it's not really that great. And so I think I'm, you know, it's always nice to hear or it's affirming to hear when research backs kind of where you feel that you're at, so that you can go, oh yeah, I'm not just like in my own world, or I'm not just feeling this thing that no one else around me is feeling. And I think especially for the audience of Children, Youth and Family podcast, I think it often feels like when we're in our own worlds of ministry that we're alone in doing this, that it's just us with this group of people, and it's all on our shoulders to make sure everybody's doing well and I'm doing well and this whole thing works well. And like, it can feel pretty isolating. And so, you know, I think it's nice to hear that it's not just me, or it's not just you.
It isn't. There was, in just last year, there was a really large scale study done of working professionals. And professionals in this case doesn't mean like professional sports. It means people. What it's basically excluding is people in the trades. So it's people like us and across the spectrum. So attorneys, all kinds. And what they found is that only 20% of people find meaning in their work, only 20% of people find their work to be life enriching. So 80% of people are exhausted and worried and then it's in. Yeah. What happens in ministry though is people are more likely to find some of those silver linings. But you made a good point. We shouldn't do that to the detriment of facing into the reality that this is really difficult work. That being in ministry is harder. I mean, now it's more culturally challenged. Oh, you believe in God? Well, you must be a racist. Or,
yeah.
So there are these very real challenges, but people in these helping and healing professions can find some of the silver linings. So there's that wonderful balance, but we got to name it. It's tough. It's getting tougher. If you're a woman or a person of color, it's all that much harder to be in ministry. And those are not trivial challenges. It's not just like, oh, darn, you know, that guy said that off-color thing to me. It's much deeper than that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we need to name it. Mm-hmm. And part of what I hope to be able to do is to be not a shrill voice, but a persistent voice in names of these things. Mm-hmm. Because shrill won't help. But as an old white dude, as a stale, pale male, maybe I can use some of that to say, these are real things. Mm-hmm. And I found them. Mm-hmm. You've not heard stale, pale.
No, I have not. That is a good one. It's good.
That's
good.
Try.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it is good to hear that people are doing well. And coming into this conversation, I just kind of assumed I would feel feelings of either conviction or maybe being indignant about how dare they put this on me or whatever. And so what about for me? Like, how do I evaluate my own wellness and, you know, tell me how bad I'm doing?
No, I don't know if you can get this out to your podcast, but I will share with you. There's a simple 10-item survey that you could take of ours, a little assessment, let's call it, where you can learn about your well-being and think about. So there's, I'll be very brief. You think about well-being as being roughly five dimensions. You know, physical health, there's your cardiovascular health and your neuromuscular. So it's the quality of your daily life experiences, call that daily well-being. Your resilience, which is your capacity to deal with the ups and downs of life and to adapt and grow. There's your sense of self-integrity, your sense of yourself as a person. Do you feel good about yourself and do you feel honored and respected by the people around you? There's your experiences of connectedness. Am I receiving the sort of social support that I need across life domains? And what we call meaning, which is the sense that you feel grounded in some deep sense of what life is about and what matters, and that you can live purposefully towards that every day. So this is this connection that people in ministry have. I know what matters in life, and my work at least sometimes allows me to do that. So those are the five areas, and then you can think about this little assessment. You can help find, well, which of those areas, which you might even be, you can think of this, like, yeah, are most of my days good days or most of my days bad days? Mm-hmm. And being honest with yourself, if they're mostly bad days, that means stress is accumulating. Do I feel like I'm responding well to the daily experiences? Do I feel resilient? That would, you know. Do I feel like I know who I am? Okay, good. Or do I feel respected in the places that I work? Can I show up in appropriate ways, but can I show up authentically and feel like people around me will honor the person that I am? This is where women and people of color often, in a fundamental way, are challenged. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something about you fundamentally that disqualifies you for the work you're doing, and they can experience that. So that might be where their self-integrity would feel. And then once you get a sense of which areas you think, yeah, I'd like to improve that, then these simple, we call them wise well-being practices are helpful. And I'm a retired professor, so of course I'm writing a book. But what I want to do in the book is help people understand the range of these practices and find the right one that works. Because there is one. I promise I won't spend too much time. Quick example. We've all heard about mindfulness meditation, right?
Yeah.
That would fit into a category I'd call tranquil practices. These are the things that slow our thinking and calm our emotions. But there are many kinds of tranquil practices. So for years I tried mindfulness meditation. Sit in the chair, my feet flat on the floor, and my back straight, and I try to focus on my breathing, and it never worked. Mm-hmm. And then one day, I was out hiking, and I literally stumbled, and I realized in that moment, I had been meditating. Hiking, I need movement. So finding a practice that you know will work, but that fits with your lifestyle. So rhythmic movement works for me, and I needed something where I could move. And so that's a part of... Sometimes we may feel compelled or somebody's told us, you got to do this practice. But if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. And you're not broken because of it. Mm-hmm. So searching for the practice that works for you may take a little time, but being willing to give yourself I don't have to do that. That may have worked for my friend. That may work for everybody I know. I was invited to meditation retreats. I'm one of the guys that's, you know, your eyes are supposed to be closed, and I'm looking around thinking, when is the break? I'm going to go outside and walk. Yeah. And that's okay then.
Yeah.
So I'll make sure to send you the... I think I know it. tiny.url/ritual new.
Okay.
Tiny.url, or is it tinyurl. That's what I do.
You can send it to us and we'll put it in the show notes.
We'll link it in our show page.
Perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
tinyurl.com/ritualnew. Thank you. tinyurl.com/ritualnew.
Cool.
Everybody got that? That's good.
Go there now. You can take the little assessment.
Awesome.
Great.
And you'll tell me if I don't answer your questions. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's good. We're putting off the judgment till later.
Just kidding. I like that.
Does anybody have a burning question that they'd like to ask?
I heard you use the term languishing, which I've heard Adam Grant use a lot to describe the state of the work world these days. What does that look like in ministry?
That's a wonderful question. So it would begin with an experience of just a lot of days in which your work doesn't seem to be in keeping with how you imagine ministry being. It just seems to be busy work or doing things that just don't matter as much. And days that might be filled with more frustration and acrimony than you had hoped for. People complaining or people around you just not being engaged in their work. So languishing would start with this, the days being either dry and dull and boring or difficult or maybe unfortunately both. Next step is where there's this growing experience of mental, physical, and spiritual tiredness that moves into exhaustion. The clinical term for that would be burnout. And those things are easy for people to overlook or to explain away, but you get to a place where you'd say, I feel this in my bones, or some sort of experience of this exhaustion being very, very deep. For people in the kinds of work that we're talking about, the next and most alarming state is where they start to wonder if this is what they should be doing at all. And they either start to misjudge themselves, I guess I really wasn't called to this, or maybe they become cynical about the work, be cynical and jaded. But that's at the stage in which languishing has really become more situated in their life, and it will be a little harder for them to turn. And then some of those people end up leaving, of course, leaving the work. But these early stages are just very, very easy to overlook or explain away or, you know, this too shall pass or something. That's those dull and dry or frustrating days and then that sense of growing exhaustion and tiredness. Adam is appealing when he says languishing. There's a lot, you know, there are some differences in people that aren't in, well, I'll just say, I'll use the term called. They're not in work that's deeply meaningful. That experience is a bit different for them. Because it might also include things like, I'm not getting paid enough. That happens in these ministry contexts, but that could be a little bit more of an acute one. And it's because sometimes they identify their value to the company with their pay. What they really need to know is that their work is valuable. So there might be a few other elements. Yeah, pay attention to those early warning signs.
How do you notice them and mitigate
them? So I'll suggest a wise well-being practice. We call it Map Your Days. So find some, it's best if you do it analog, a piece of paper or a calendar that you will be able to see at the end of your work days. And do, it's a simple practice where at the end of the day, without overjudging, I use a smiley face or a frowny face. Just say, was this a good day or a bad day? Smiley face if it was a good day, frowny face if it was a bad day. You can use terms, whatever you want, but don't overjudge, don't second guess yourself, just go with the gut feeling. And then very briefly write about a high point for the day and a low point for the day. You decide. Always be telling yourself, don't censor, don't self-judge, just put it down. And do that for a couple of weeks, and then look back. And notice what were the high points on those good days. And that will tell you a lot about the things that you can build into your days that will help you flourish. And notice and be honest about the things that are the low points on the difficult days. So some of those you might be able to do something about. You might actually, as hard as it be, you may be able to address. But some of them you can't. And so you'll know the high point things, try to build those into those difficult days. But one of the things we think we know what makes our days difficult, but we don't. And so this is a real raise your hand quiz. So how many of you can remember what you had for your last meal of the day yesterday? You can remember the last meal you had yesterday, how many can remember? Okay, great. How about last week, Tuesday last week? Or how about Wednesday 6 months ago? Can you remember what the last meal of your day was? So we think we know what's happening in our days, but we just don't. So the stressors, the joys and sorrows, if you will, of your days, you have a vague idea, and there's some truth to that, but you probably don't know enough of the specifics. And Map Your Day helps you get in to the stuff that's really going on and that's really adding up. So that would be a simple practice. And I do that regularly. And if I start to feel some of these things I mentioned, the days are feeling dry and boring, or I'm feeling a little bit exhausted, that's one of the first things I do to help me, first of all, be honest about what's going on, and second of all, to identify what some of the things are. Now, part of that, again, maybe there's just, maybe you've got a cranky curmudgeon that you work with, and you can't change him. But then you might be able to find ways of working around that person, or talking to other people, or relying on other people. And you know what? Honestly, sometimes it's okay to complain about people, because that can be a wise well-being practice. Sure, if you denigrate them, you've gone too far. But it's okay to say, that Matt Bloom is a pain in the neck to work with. He's so grumpy, and I have to go into his office, and he's always cranky. Sometimes complaining helps. But research also shows if we just name the things that are difficult, they're a little less difficult for us. There's something about being honest with ourselves that really helps. And Adam named something earlier. And if you can commiserate with somebody about it, they can say, yeah, that Bloom character is a pain in the... That helps the both of you. So little practices.
I'm thinking about... we're talking specifically about ministry professionals or people in helping professions, but so much, I feel like, of what I do in ministry is about the well-being of other people. And there's so much research and so much talk right now about the mental health state of our teenagers. And so I'm curious what you might have to say for those of us who are trying to help in those areas when it seems so bleak. Right? That there's just, it's insurmountable, the amount of mental health crises that are happening, and people don't know how to come alongside one another, especially teenagers. I think there's a generational gap like, well, in my day, blah, blah, blah.
Just up and,
exactly.
Which is not true. I mean, it's just revisionist history. Yeah, my wife works on a college campus in the counseling center, and young people, late teens to late 20s, are the group where mental health needs are growing at a fastest pace. We know that there's a shortage of mental health workers. So some of it is, there are some things we can do, but also realizing that sometimes what we can do is small steps, that sort of that theme. So one of the things I think you can do that you already know is try to pay attention to your own well-being and model that there's something good in that, and to be authentically who you are. My sense is that what young people need is adults who are just true to themselves. They need role models of people who could be true to themselves. And I know that's not always easy, and I know that can be, but to the extent that you can be that, as true as you can be, let's say, as true as you can be. I know another thing I'm going to say is just being that constant abiding presence of love and affirmation. And these things are not going to show up immediately. Like, they're going to build up over the long run. Because I think they need this stability in their life. They need to know, okay, in whatever way they might think about it, Elizabeth, Danica, Adam, they're the same people when I show up. They're stable. They're grounded. I can depend on them to be abiding presences of love. And that's missing for a lot of us. It's missing for a lot of adults. Just those people who say, in whatever way, through actions, you're a good person, you're a beloved. And I think those are really important things. My wife and I have talked. There's some freedoms that young people have now that have a really good side to it, but can actually create problems of their own, like gender identity. It's great that it's just not boys and girls. But on the other hand, they experience the sense that, oh my gosh, now I have to choose or something. So being a place where they can just work through some of these things, which I think you're doing, is really important. But again, in that moment of working through, or there's 100 moments of working through, they're probably not going to go, oh, gosh, yes, I feel good about myself. This is awesome. But knowing that they can come to you and and work through some of those things, I think is really important. So those are at least three things that I see as being important. And in some ways, wouldn't we all love that? People who just love and care for us, and people we can go to. And we had, several years ago, Kim and I developed a practice that we called the weather report, because I wasn't being very good at this. And the way the weather report works is, when one of us comes home from work, we live apart most of the week, so when we're on the phone, if you say, I have a weather report, for 10 minutes, you get to say whatever you need to say about the day, and the other person is just there to listen and affirm you. Mm. So that part I was not good at. I wanted to fix it, so I wasn't good at it. The reason it's 10 minutes is because my weather reports might go on for a long time. Mm. And I tend to circle around the problem, which is not a good thing. And what we need to do is express the problem and then stop there, because circling back won't work. Mm. And so in whatever form might be helpful, can you also be a weather report? They can complain about their parents or whatever they need to, and you listen. And then when they start to circle back, you start to say, well, let's move on from this. So that might be a fourth thing.
Yeah, wow. Cool.
Any other questions?
Or, I thought you had one.
I mean, I do have something. I just didn't want to jump on anyone else. I think one of the most difficult things, and I'll just speak from my own perspective. I think one of the most difficult things about well-being or going down the path of well-being is the amount of shame that I carry when I feel like I can't follow through on a practice, or I'm not making strides to becoming better at the thing that I know that I need to become better at. I'm not measuring up at home with my spouse or at work or in whatever part of life it is. As we were talking about young people, I know that is a constant struggle for this generation of young people, is just like the constant feeling of not being able to measure up. And so that's kind of where some of the resistance and going the other direction is coming from, and also the mental health struggles that we're talking about too. I don't know what the question is about that. I just want, like, that's something that I, when we're talking about well-being, that always just kind of seems to be the stumbling block for me, and I know probably for a lot of people, is just the amount of like shame and the feeling of that like, if I'm not well, or if I'm working towards well-being, that means that I'm starting from a place of deficiency or not enough. And I would imagine that you would say something differently to that, which is when you were talking about like the mapping your days, right? Like, don't add judgment into that. Just like write it down. I'm curious if you could go a little bit more into that, about the shame and that feeling of just like, what does unwell mean about me, or what does going towards well-being mean about me?
It's a great question. I have a couple of thoughts that are, again, arise from all of the work that we've and other people have done. One of them is that we live in a culture that really, really encourages social comparison, and that's really, really detrimental to our well-being. Mm-hmm. And so some of that is commiserating with other people to talk about that. I mean, other parts of it are really, you know, trying to monitor yourself. Like, I'm just off social media. For a long time, I was a part of a professional social media called LinkedIn. I'm still on LinkedIn, but I don't check it very often. And you see people struggling with this on LinkedIn, like these posts. I'm so humbled by being voted the most amazing person in my organization. But it's their struggle to try to feel good about themselves. Yeah. So those environments just encourage this feeling of inadequacy and encourage us to compare ourselves to others. And another way of thinking about it is, Seneca supposedly said this many centuries ago, everybody you meet is carrying a great burden, and that we don't share our burdens as often. I don't want to be a problem. I don't want to be a whiner. That's my reason for doing it. But finding at least a few people to be able to just express those and be affirmed that, that's very realistic. You're not broken. You're not abnormal. We all really do struggle. And I've had the opportunity to talk to some people that culturally, you're at the top, you're amazing, and yet they have these deep and profound struggles, and they often feel the sense of shame around them. Like, I'm this person that's well-known, I've got all these resources, why should I feel inadequate? Shouldn't I feel good about myself? So it's really being willing to share that. And then this might not be that helpful, but again, one of the little mottos or mantras we try to encourage is that no matter where you are in your well-being journey, there's a next step you can take. You can do something, mm-hmm. and it's these small things, and we don't have to make these big changes. And this is where our faith can be so helpful. You know, that we are told that in our brokenness, we are loved. Not in spite of our brokenness. Mm-hmm. You know, not, okay, we add you up and there's more good than bad, mm-hmm. but we are loved for who we are, and just trying to encourage and affirm each other in that can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. But culture, our culture, yeah. there's a wonderful book I read by Justine Bateman, I think it's called Face, and she talks about, she was getting older and she wasn't doing the cosmetic surgery, and people were like, you look old, and she thought, I'm proud of my wrinkles. And for women, you know, aging for all of us, but for women in particular. So there are just powerful forces coming at us that are always telling us, compare yourselves and you will be, and by the way, whatever you compare yourself to, you're going to be inadequate. Mm-hmm. So can we work against that in the ways, be aware of it? And that's why I just decided to, I miss the messages from people, and that's okay. I just don't want to go into LinkedIn and, and honestly, I feel so bad for those people. I am humbled by, I know you're, there's an expression of pain there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to say that. Well. So I'm going to normalize it. We feel these things, and sometimes being upfront with the people we can and just commiserating and saying, yeah, I feel that way too.
So my question is about theological concepts or frameworks or even like liturgies that will actually double down on the comparison culture.
Thank you for bringing up theologies.
I've been struggling with those. And even though I know that's not what they're meant to do, maybe, unfortunately, culturally, they've jumped up on the comparison culture. And so it's really important, how do we start to work to undo those and unhook the God parts that are icky, that go with what you were talking about, with the inadequacies or not enough? Or
I might, just from my perspective, and with, I'm not a theologian, but I don't think we have rich theologies of well-being. And I think we need to work together, not trite trivial ones, not proof texting a few Bible verses, but really working to develop a deep theology of well-being. And I've been working with some theologians and delighted that there's some interest in it, but we need those so that we can say, this is why well-being matters. This is what it is, and this is how it can be rooted in my faith. And for many pastors, many, many pastors, they struggle, and they'll say, well, Jesus and at least 11 of the disciples died for their ministry. Is that our theology of ministry flourishing? Hmm. You know, so how do you ground it in something? Because that's your meaning system. That's how you think about the world. And so perhaps with each other, helping to articulate a theology that's not socially comparative, but that is also theology of well-being, so that human flourishing becomes a part of how you think about what the abundant life is. And you know, we don't have stories of Jesus being fun, but he had to be, right? Because all these people who weren't his followers wanted to be with him, and we generally don't want to be with somebody who's morose, like, I'm going to die for you, so follow me. So he must have been a blast to be with. He must have been great. He probably danced. And we're missing some of those. But I think if you look at what happened in the Bible, it's illogical that he was anything but. He probably told great jokes. He was certainly kind and compassionate. So we miss those elements of what our theology of flourishing would be like. But I bet thousands of people who weren't his followers wanted to be with him. He must have been really great.
He turned water into wine. He was real fun.
Awesome. No. Amen. And I have a feeling he turned a lot of water.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Like, he's the one that's saying, you need more.
Yeah.
No, I've had enough. No, please let me pour.
Still one glass if it's not empty.
This is the good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He's handing out the big goblets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So anyway, let's, a theology of well-being might be a part of it.
Well, so we have one question we like to ask, and you have shared so many helpful things.
Oh,
and
I hope so.
Really, truly, I'll listen to this probably a few times to remember. But I will. This podcast is for professionals and volunteers in children, youth, and family ministry. What is something you would want to communicate to them?
I'll just say what's in my heart. You are on the front lines of a group that needs your ministry and your care. Oh, we've all, that's a group that's always needed it, but I think now more than ever. And the work you're doing won't bear fruit in front of you. And there's a real truth that the fruit will be born later on. And so praise God that you're doing the work. We'll pray for you and keep doing it. But it really matters. You just won't see it. It's the toughest, some of the toughest work, because you just won't see it. And what you'll probably see is evidence that it's not making a difference. I think you'll see that more readily. So if I said it concisely, the work that you're doing is incredibly important with a group that desperately needs it, and know that your work will bear fruit over the long run. And if it doesn't today, have faith.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed that great conversation with Dr. Matt Bloom. Before we go, here are a few announcements and reminders. The next Oasis is coming up really soon on April 27th. The teaching guest is Reverend Dr. Chuck Hunt. It's going to be a great event, and I encourage you to check it out. Go to the network website at elcawyomnet.org/oasis for more information. Thanks so much for listening. New podcasts will be released on the third Tuesday of every month. Be sure to subscribe so you receive them as they come out, and share with your friends. And finally, thanks to Paul Amlin, the 3TC producer, for his work. Have a fantastic week. Bye.